Hi everyone. My name is Hannah Analora. I am the marketing producer with GA Denver. We are trying out our first listen and learn event today here with Dan Moore. The event you're joining in on is Lessons for New Developers. If you aren't familiar with General Assembly, General Assembly is a global education company. So we help people find the work that they love through education. How we do that is through our immersive programming and software engineering, UX design, data science, and we've got some part-time programming that you can do on the evenings and weekends, and then short-form classes and workshops. But some of my favorite things that we do are these free events where we bring in industry experts to talk about what they love. So with that, you're going to be hearing from Dan Moore today. And he's going to be saying a little bit about some lessons for new developers.
Thank you so much, Hannah. And thank you all for joining us. I really appreciate your time today. So I am going to talk today about lessons for new developers. In order to kind of anchor what I'm saying, the advice I'm giving, I think it's always good to provide some context. So I have been a software developer, technical trainer, engineering manager, startup co-founder, and contractor, as well as a new developer myself way back in the day. I've been writing code for about 20 years. And for some additional context, I'm a cis white male, and I also have mostly been in the Denver metro area. So if you are, for instance, looking to get a job at a company in San Francisco or to travel the world, be a digital nomad, some of this advice may still apply, but some of it may not. The other thing to note is that the vast majority of my experience has been doing web and kind of back-end software development with smaller companies. I have worked for some larger ones, Oracle and Level 3, but a lot of my work has been with companies under 100 people. So that all said, I think that the first tip I want to say is that software is a huge, big world. And the skills that you're going to need, the technical skills you're going to need as a game developer or as a operating system developer are different than the technical skills you'll need to be a web developer. But there are a lot of what some people call soft skills. I think they're pretty hard. There are a lot of soft skills that are going to transfer across. And so that's some of the stuff I'm going to talk about today. The other thing I would say around context is that from my point of view, the best job for a new developer starting out that doesn't have, if they don't have like a firm goal in mind, like, hey, I really want to, again, write games, or I really want to work for Google. The best job is at a small consulting company. Now, I'm going to define these because I'm not sure who my audience is. Basically, there are two main types of software companies in the world: product companies, which build software that they then sell, which is a really awesome scalable business model because the marginal cost of creating a new software instance is close to zero, depending on how you measure it. And then there are consulting companies, and consulting companies sell hours essentially to other companies. And those other companies may buy from the consulting company because of specific skills the consulting company has, or because the consulting company can help augment the client company's staff, or because the client company has no staff and they just need some short-term projects done. Whatever the case, they engage with the consulting company, and then the consulting company does the work, and then the consulting company may move on or may come back in a year, or, so there may be an ongoing relationship or maybe kind of a one and done relationship. And the reason why I think that a consulting company is a really great place to start your career at is because it gives you a breadth of skills and a breadth of experience in a way that is in kind of a safe environment. Because basically what happens is, for a consulting company, you come in and you are staffed on a project and you do the project and you learn the business domain right? Whether that's real estate or law or finance or agriculture or consumer retail, whatever it is, you're going to learn some of that domain, and then you're going to be pulled off that project when it ends. And then you're going to move on to another project in a different domain, possibly with a different technology, certainly with different team members and different client members. And so that rapid fire switching, and those projects may last, you know, weeks, months, maybe 1 or 2 years is kind of the longest typical project I've seen. So you basically get a bunch of different experience. It's like holding a bunch of different jobs, except for you don't have to change your where your checks go to, and you don't have to interview. So you gain this huge breadth of experience. After 2 or 3 years, you should have a much better understanding of what you're excited about, like what domains you're excited about, what technologies you're excited about, what technologies clients are excited about. And you may be able to move around within the consulting company depending on the size, or you may have to leave the company. But at the end of the day, you'll have gotten this basically tour. It's like a world tour of an area of software engineering that that consulting company covers. The reason why I think it's good for you to work at a small company, and by small, I mean, you know, maybe under 1,000, maybe under 500 people. So not that small, but not like a McKinsey, like you know, a 10 or 20 or 30,000 person consulting company. The reason why I think you should work for a small one is because your work will really matter. It matters to the consulting company. It matters to the client. You'll get a chance to interact with other team members, both within the engineering team and in other areas like product or customer service. You'll probably get a chance to interact with the client, and you'll, the contributions you make, the hours you work will materially matter to the company. And so I think that's just a great place to be, because it means, because that's true of you, it's also true of everybody else. And so at about 100 people or so, my experience is you end up finding people that maybe are not as enthusiastic about software and about the company as they are just interested in collecting a paycheck. And there's nothing wrong with just collecting a paycheck. I just find it's more fun to work with people that are enthusiastic and interested in the problems we're solving and the people we're helping. So that was tip number one, is really consider small consulting companies. A bonus is that they don't tend to have great training budgets, right? They also tend to, because of the economics of the model, be more willing to hire entry-level developers. And I know that there are some in the Denver metro area that actually have like intern programs. And I actually worked for a company that was 100% remote that also had like a, basically a kind of a prove it contract. So they are flexible when it comes to hiring less experienced talent. Let's jump into some things that I think will help you be successful, whether or not you ever work for a small consulting company. So I think these are gonna be tips that will help you even if you go work at Google or Oracle or, you know, some big behemoth product company. The first is, it's really important to let people know what you're doing. And there are a variety of different ways to do this, but especially as a new team member, you want to make sure that you're being very transparent about what you're doing. And that is going to help you when you're blocked, because people will kind of have the context already. It will also help you educate your manager about what your skills are and, you know, what you're good at, what you're not good at. And also, frankly, just the progress you're making. Because managers, when I first started out, I thought managers kind of knew everything, and they had their, you know, they sat up in their chair in their office and were looking and keeping an eye on everybody and everything. And the honest truth is that managers have jobs too, and things that they're trying to deliver as well. And they don't always know what you're doing. So by letting people know what you're doing, you, especially your manager, but other team members, you basically are communicating the successes you're having and the problems you're facing. And that is a good thing to just get in the habit of doing, because what you don't want to be is a coder who goes off in a corner and doesn't communicate and isn't part of a team that's not working toward the business's goals. How can you do this? Well, there are a couple of different ways, but the most important thing is actually that you do it in a way that's one that you can maintain, and two, that's consistent with what the team wants. And so, you know, I've seen daily standups. I've seen where you have a Google Doc that you just kind of keep updated. I've seen task lists. I've seen ticketing systems. It doesn't really matter exactly what the means are of doing this, except for you don't want to jump into a job and come with your own preconceptions and say, hey, this is the way I want to like keep you updated on status. You want to say, hey, team, how do you do this? Now, if they say we don't do this, then I would suggest that you talk to your manager and say, hey, I've found that this really works well for me to kind of keep track of what I'm doing and to keep you in the loop. How would you feel about me putting in a Google Doc or me using Asana and just CCing you? So I think you need to be flexible about the means of keeping people in the loop, but I think you definitely want to keep as many people in the loop as want to be in the loop about your tasks. And again, finally, like, you know, expectations differ around the amount of reporting, the type of stuff you want to do. And you also obviously want to make sure that the detail with which you share what you're doing doesn't actually impede you actually doing the thing. So don't write a paragraph or a sentence will do. And finally, expectations do differ between different companies and different teams and different managers on different teams. So life at Oracle was a lot different than life at a startup. So that's kind of tip number one, is definitely always let people know what you're doing and do it in a way that's consistent with the team. The second tip that I'm going to share is to ask questions. And that you may think, hey, that's really an obvious tip, right? But I have definitely run into new developers and frankly, some more experienced developers that had trouble doing this. And so there's a couple of things to think about when you're asking questions. The first is my recommendation would be to do it in as public a format as you possibly can. So sending a direct DM to one person is not as good as sending a DM to a couple of people, which is not as good as asking in a public chat. And I want to acknowledge and realize the discomfort in, especially when you're new at a job, saying, hey, I don't know how to do this thing that seems so obvious that like will probably take someone who's experienced in this position or familiar with this system, you know, 2 minutes to do. It's taken me a long time because I don't really know my way around. It's a very uncomfortable position to be in. But when you ask that question in public, a couple of good things happen. One is, again, you're automatically letting people know what they're doing, what you're doing, basically for the price of the question. Second, it's going to force you to ask a question with more detail because you don't want to look like a fool, right? So you're going to do some more research. Maybe that will cause you to actually do research to actually, which will actually turn up the answer to the question. You don't know. But I definitely know that when I prepare to write a question out, whether I'm posting on Stack Overflow or an internal Slack, the very act of writing out the question actually causes me to see other avenues for exploration and other things that maybe I should look at to try to get an answer to the question. And the last thing that asking a question in public does is it educates everybody else. So chances are that you're not the only person with this question, or you certainly are not the only person to have ever thought of this question. And so when you ask it, preferably in like a written format, then that becomes something that is visible to other people at that time or visible to people from the future. And that is just a general win. Now, again, this is context sensitive. I think that there are probably places with thousands of employees where you want to kind of limit the question asking to people in your team, for example. And again, you should also kind of check in with your manager, check in with your teammates and kind of ask like, hey, you know, how do questions get answered around here? Frankly, I think that's a good indicator of the health of the team, because if someone new asks a question and it doesn't get answered, that means either the team is ignoring it, which is pretty crappy to do, or they're so strapped that they can't spare the time to look at any questions. Or worse, it might be a toxic environment and you actually get berated for asking a question, which to me is just a really poor choice. I haven't actually worked in any of those environments. I've heard about places like that. I don't know how you test that out at an interview, but maybe asking, you know, how do people handle knowledge transfer or something like that might be helpful. So I did already mention that you should do research around a question. You can do things like, you know, searching internal docs, searching Google or DuckDuckGo, and also just kind of poking around yourself. I always tell people that are reporting to me, I always say, you know, spend 15 to 30 minutes trying to figure something out, and then I want you to ask a question, because there's value in you searching something out. There's also value in me or somebody else experienced short-circuiting something. So if you are looking to, you know, how to build a certain component, you know, it's possible, it's actually valuable for you to try to figure it out yourself, because we want to build self-documenting systems as much as we possibly can, because it's a great way to scale engineering teams. But there's also value in you trying for a period of time and then saying, hey, I can't do this, asking a public Slack channel, and then me taking the 5 minutes or 25 minutes, whatever it is, to actually walk you through it. And then probably the very next thing I'm going to ask you to do is say, hey, please document what you learned, so that the next person has an easier time. An example of a bad question is, I can't build project XYZ. That's actually not even a question, but it doesn't have any context. It doesn't tell anybody who's reading the question or hearing the question what you've tried to do, where you got stuck, whether you could even find project XYZ, because that could be an issue. A good version of that question is, I looked at project XYZ in GitHub. I read the README. I was able to clone it and download it, or clone it and start looking at the code. But it says that I need to install Ruby 2.8. I Googled around. I couldn't find any references to Ruby 2.8. I'm not sure how to get that. It seems like 2.7 and 3.0 are the only valid versions of Ruby. Is there something missing? Should I update the README? And this is a good question, because it tells the people that might be able to help you kind of how far you got. It shows that you actually did some work on your own, right? You did some research, you tried to solve the problem, and also gives them, you know, the possibility to give you a couple of action items. And so it shows that you're willing to do some work to help make life better for everybody else. It's possible that 2.8 was actually a typo, or it's possible that they have an internal fork of Ruby 2.8, right? They forked Ruby 2.7 and they added in their own modules and are calling that Ruby 2.8. I don't know. It's a totally made up conversation or made up scenario. So in summary, ask questions. It's good to do it in public as you can possibly force yourself, because it has a lot of other benefits. And make sure you do some research, but not too much, before you actually ask those questions. Another tip for success is to make mistakes once, not two times. And then, you know, the honest truth is that we all make mistakes. So when you make a mistake, you want to own it, document it, and fix it. So an example from my personal life, my personal career, is that I worked for a consulting company and we had a marquee client. They had an event. It was a sporting event that was televised, and we were responsible for the website. And I was responsible for this website, basically the senior engineer on the project, for 2 years. And the first year I was really nervous. And so I load tested things. I made sure I understood kind of all the pieces and was confident that we could handle all the traffic. Because as you can imagine, being on a network TV results in a lot of traffic to a website. The second year I was sloppy and busy and overworked. And so I didn't do the prep work. I didn't load test it. And that caused the website to fall over during the event. And it was an extremely unpleasant experience. It gives me the chills just talking about it right now. Never fun to have that kind of conversation about downtime with the client, but even less so a nationally recognized name that's responsible for a good chunk of your company's income. But I took those steps. I talked about, basically we had a call after the website fell over and after the event was done with the client. We explained what had happened. We documented the issue. We built some process around it. And then we fixed the proximate issue, but we also went in and fixed the root issue as well. If you're curious, the root issue was that there was a configuration change that wasn't tracked in code and wasn't tracked in GitHub. And that configuration change caused different servers to be accessed than should have been accessed. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. The point is that I actually, because this was a really big issue, I actually spent a significant amount of time automating some fixes. So I built a piece of software to run and examine that configuration and make sure that there was nothing that would enable this kind of issue to happen in the future. There are times when you make a mistake that's not a website falling over on national TV. And in that case, you don't necessarily need to go to those tremendous lengths to fix it, but you still should fix it. Whether that's talking to other team members or talk, if it's a data fix, like cleaning up the data as best you can, you know, and you don't necessarily need to do everything yourself. You just need to own seeing that through to completion to rectify your mistake. It could be as simple as if you misname a variable in a PR, accepting that's the wrong way to name it according to your team's conventions, possibly filing changing the linter to actually catch that in the future, but making note yourself that, oh, I always need to name a variable this way so that you, again, make the mistake once. All mistakes, in my mind, in my experience, are pretty forgivable one time. What's not forgivable is if you don't learn from your mistakes and improve. I think that one great practice is to use automated testing. I worked at a startup. I was technical co-founder of a startup, and we had some pretty complicated business logic around our billing system. And what I ended up doing was every time there was a mistake, and there were plenty of mistakes that I made around that billing system, which as you can imagine is lower stakes than a website falling over on national TV, but higher stakes than a misnamed variable. There were times when I had to call my customers and say, hey, I really screwed up your billing. Here's how I'm going to fix it. And every time I had one of those kind of situations, either whether I called the customers or whether it was something we discovered beforehand or only affected a smaller number of customers, I would write a test for that. And that turned into a really great regression suite that enabled me to make changes to that code base, which was fairly complex, with a lot of confidence. And I'll tell you, those tests weren't the prettiest thing. I was kind of shooting from the hip and learning that particular framework as I went, but I was so happy that I had them. And every time we deployed, I would make sure that all those tests ran and they saved my bacon a number of times. The last tip I want to run through, because I think I'm running towards the end of my time, is I want to make sure that you just show up, right? You would be surprised at how many people don't show up. And you may have dealt with people like that in previous jobs. There may be, unfortunately, some classmates of yours or people that you've known in your life that don't necessarily show up all the time. And I think that there's a number of reasons why showing up and doing the work and trying to improve is going to make your life better. The first is that it's just more fun to do work when you show up and you're engaged. If you show up and you hate your job, you know, I think that especially if you're a developer with a year or two of experience, you should switch your job. Now, right now, I understand, I'm not sure my audience, but if you are trying to get into the developer job market or the technology job market, and you're coming in with zero experience, you know, you should take pretty much any job you can, because getting that year or two of experience that's solid will open up a lot of possibilities to you. But anyway, and I think if you're engaged in your work and you're showing up, you're going to build a reputation. And this building of a technical reputation is not about your success in that job, although it definitely will help that. It's about success in finding your third, fourth, and fifth jobs. And I can tell you that I think 60% of my jobs or contracts have come from people that I know. And even in my last job hunt, even with 20 years of experience, even having been in this area for a long time, I'll tell you that I was a lot more successful with the people by handing my resume to people who knew me or had interacted with me in some way and knew my reputation and knew who I was, even if it was really peripherally, than I did applying to jobs where I didn't know anybody. And so the final bit about that, and this is a little bit different than showing up, it's more in line with the reputation. Make sure you sign up for LinkedIn. Make sure you connect to people both in your classes and also in jobs that you end up getting, and keep track of those people and reach out to them and help support them, not just when you need help, but when they need help. And that could be as simple as liking a post they make on LinkedIn, sharing something interesting they've done. But if you do that over the years, again, your third, fourth, and fifth jobs will be much easier to find. That I think is time. So I want to say thank you again.
Awesome.
Yeah, I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Dan. That was fantastic. We really appreciate you coming in today and giving some great lessons, because I think that was really important. And I think you made some really great points. So appreciate everyone coming to our inaugural Listen and Learn. And it looks like we did have somebody comment in the chat with a hand clap. So
thank you.
And hope to see everyone online again soon, or have you join in these more Listen and Learn sessions. And have a great rest of your afternoon, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks, Dan. Bye.